It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomchik with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No job for one or two more weeks. We don't know.
for at least another week.
Yeah, that's thinking. So still plenty to cover, and starting out with local and Richard McIver.
Oh, yeah. The news broke this week that McIver, who had been hit with an ethics fine by the Seattle Ethics and Election Commission because he had awarded a contract to a friend, he had awarded a city contract to a friend whose condo in the Virgin Islands he had vacationed at, and who had also in turn vacationed at his property in Mexico. And, of course, that appears to be a conflict of interest, which violates Seattle ethics rules. He was hit with a fine, and instead of paying it out of his own pocket, excuse me, he got the city, under a little used city law, he got the city to pay the fine for him. Now, the city law says that it will pay fines for employees that are engaged in misconduct, but not for, in financial misconduct, but not for fraudulent, criminal, or malicious behavior. Well, of course, McIver didn't think that he did anything wrong, even though he broke ethics law. And after a stink this week in the news, he finally said, well, I'll pay it out of pocket, okay. But this is just like him, you know, and it's just like the kind of Nichols big city politics that the city's treasury is there to be used for me and my friends and the developers who are my buddies, et cetera. And I'm not responsible for, you know, keeping track of taxpayer funds and where they go or anything. It just really shows the profound arrogance of the clique that's running the city right now, Mayor Nichols and his buddies on the city council.
Yeah, I should have pointed out he is a city councilman. So.
Yeah, he's a city councilman. And unfortunately, he's not going to be up for re-election next year, so there's no opportunity to vote him out of office. But he is on the way out.
All right. Moving on to the state level and Dino Rossi's campaign.
Oh, yeah. No, we also heard this week that Dino Rossi has received $1 million in his campaign fund from an out-of-state organization, the Republican Governors Association. And this is after Rossi and his members of his campaign were getting down on Governor Gregoire for taking out-of-state money from major Democratic donors. And I think, you know, all the fuss over that was really just envy, because clearly it didn't lead to Rossi making any kind of pledge to not take out-of-state money, because here he is, you know, with a handout and collecting quite a bit from the Republican Party and from Republican national associations. And it just kind of points to the fact that right now in this close governor's race, there's so much money involved to try to get a Republican to oust Governor Gregoire. And it really points to the need for systemic change. You know, we should have limits on campaign spending as well as on campaign funding. And it's really the limits on campaign spending that I think would be much more effective. And we could also have requirements for free advertising in order to get the candidates' messages out. This would take the ball. It would remove the way that we do elections now, which is electing the richest person rather than the person who is best suited for the job, I think.
All right. Moving on, the Wassail.
Yeah. No, there was also news this week about the Wassail. Evidently, most 10th and 12th graders have passed the test, but when it came to evaluating how Seattle schools and schools in the state of Washington did under the No Child Left Behind Act, what we found was that 628 schools in the state have failed under No Child Left Behind, and that's a jump of over 120%, more than double the number of last year. The number of districts in the state that were added to the needs improvement list almost doubled as well, from 30 to 57. There are now, there are a minimum of some 37 distinct categories for evaluating a single school under No Child Left Behind. And if a school fails to show improvement in any one of those categories, then they end up being declared having failed under No Child Left Behind. In Seattle, some 43 out of 97 schools in the district are on the needs improvement list. That's about 44% of the total. And that includes almost all of the city's high schools. In addition, many schools that failed last year under No Child Left Behind made significant progress over last year, but they still failed because the bar is moved higher every year. So it's almost like these schools are running in a race and they see the finish line receding in the distance, even though they're running harder and faster than they were last year. Of course, what are the effects when you fail under No Child Left Behind? The effects in this state are pretty few because the state law prohibits most of them. For example, firing teachers and other staff at a school are pretty much prohibited by contracts with the teachers union. And charter schools, which would be allowed under the federal law, No Child Left Behind, are not allowed in the state of Washington. And also, the federal law allows states to take over schools that have failed, but that's also prohibited by state law. So the one thing that is a real sanction under No Child Left Behind for the state of Washington is that Superintendent of Public Schools Terry Burgesson could withhold federal funds from schools that receive it if they failed. However, Burgesson hasn't really done that yet, and she's not willing to do that, particularly in an election year. And you might ask, two, what is Burgesson actually doing to try to help not just Seattle schools, but Washington State schools meet No Child Left Behind, or even, you know, mitigate some of the rules under the federal law, which appear to be punishing a lot of these schools? She's actually not doing very much. In fact, on Thursday, Burgesson released a proposal that would make very small changes to No Child Left Behind, and that proposal included things like limiting testing to grades 4, 7, and 10, so 12th graders would not be tested under the WASL. And she didn't say whether passing the WASL would still be a requirement for graduating, so that I'm assuming that would still be in place. You'd just have to take it in the 10th grade and pass in order to graduate. And if you didn't pass in the 10th grade, you'd be taking it in the 11th grade, the 12th grade, et cetera, et cetera. She also proposed more federal funds for teachers and tutors. And my question there is, where in the heck are those funds going to come from? Because obviously there's no money in the federal treasury to give to states for anything, much less for education. And she suggested separate tests for special education students and for students who are from other countries and for whom English is a second language. It makes you ask, how come this wasn't originally designed into the WASL in the first place, since it's arisen as a major problem in the WASL the last few years? And of course, her proposal included nothing to address the punitive nature of No Child Left Behind. Instead of awarding schools that pass and telling schools that don't pass, well, do better and you can get these incentives, No Child Left Behind is structured as a punitive thing. If you don't pass, then you lose federal funding. You have all these terrible things that could happen to you. And if your state prohibits some of those terrible things from happening to you, you have the shame of the publicity involved, which means you lose a lot of the really good students whose parents take you out of that school and take their kids out of that school and move them to other schools, thereby ensuring that the school will never reach the goals set in No Child Left Behind. So instead of saying, let's address the punitive nature of the federal law, Burgesson proposed these little tiny fixes. And, she could get together with other state superintendents and say, let's just call for a repeal of No Child Left Behind. After all, this is a year when we've had a Democratic-controlled Congress. You would think the Democrats would be sympathetic to some of these issues and would be able to pass a law that repeals much of No Child Left Behind if it doesn't repeal the entire act. But of course, Burgesson has not been a leader on that issue. And she's looking at a really strong race this year against Randy Dorn, who's running on the platform of let's get rid of No Child Left Behind, let's get rid of the WASL. So I think she's in deep trouble. And this proposal was an attempt to try to address that all that support that Dorn is getting. And once again, she fell short.
All right. Moving on, Boeing, and it's looking like a strike is on the horizon.
Yeah, the leaders of the Boeing Machinists Union called for a strike this week. They've been in negotiations since May with Boeing for a new 3-year contract. The contract expires next week, so Boeing employees are going to be voting on Wednesday. They're going to be taking two votes. The first vote will be on the company's proposed contract, and the second vote will be on whether or not to authorize a strike if the contract is voted down. The main contention that the union has is that the last two contracts had no pay raises. So over the past 4 years, the Boeing employees have had essentially no pay raise, while Boeing made some $13 billion in profits last year. Now the machinists are saying, okay, look, we've gone 4 years without any pay raise, so now it's time for us to get pay. And they're looking at the company's offer of an 11% increase over the next 3 years as pretty meager when you spread it out. And when you include the last 4 years of no increases, that's 7 years with an 11% increase. That's barely the cost of living. And when you look at the inflation rate this year, which is running at like 4 to 5%, then it's less than a cost of living increase. So they're saying 11% is not enough. We really need at least 13%. So it's looking like the contract offer could be voted down on Wednesday, and strike, which employees had taken a kind of a preliminary vote in July. The union had held this vote to take the temperature of their employees and say, are you behind us if we push for higher pay raises? And the employees came back and said, yes, we will strike if we don't get more. So it's looking like they'll vote once again to strike this next week. So we'll see. The company's in kind of a bind right now. The 787 Dreamliner project is already more than a year behind schedule, and the further it falls behind in schedule, the more in penalties Boeing owes to its customers for not delivering planes on time. It's all those penalties are already in the billions of dollars, so there's a big incentive for Boeing to get with the program if the employees vote to strike. So we'll see how that goes this next week.
Well, I remember last time around, Boeing said they definitely wouldn't miss another deadline on that plane.
We'll see. I mean, if they strike, if there's a strike for a week, maybe they won't. But if there's a strike for longer than that, well, we'll see.
All right. Moving on to National, and it now appears we know who
the VP candidates are.
The VP candidates are for our future.
Yeah. No, it's kind of pathetic. You know, I heard the announcement of the VP candidates, and then the way it plays out in the media, it's almost like there's this tally of pain. You know, let's put Joe Biden's the death of his wife on, you know, on one side of the ledger, and then on the other side of the ledger is Governor Palin's Down syndrome child. I mean, it just becomes ridiculous. You want to say, okay, other than the fact that these people have been through these personal tragedies, what else recommends them for the job? When we look at their the strengths and weaknesses, you know, a lot of the media coverage has been on the strengths of these candidates and what they bring to their party's tickets. If we look at their real weaknesses, though, which haven't been enumerated in the media, it kind of points to I think the farcical nature of the whole race. This race we call the presidents for the presidency, you know, where we're supposed to have two opposing parties, and the two parties are looking closer together all the time. On the one hand, you have Biden, who was kind of pointed out in the media as being great for Obama because he has age and experience, and he's a foreign policy expert, and he has these blue-collar roots in a, you know, and he comes from a swing state, Pennsylvania. You know, he's more emotional than Obama, who's kind of a cool and slick and reserved guy, and Biden would also bring the white, you know, working class vote into the Obama camp. Well, if we look on the other side of the ledger, the real ledger of what are his strengths and weaknesses as a candidate, we see that Biden's age sort of sabotages Obama's whole, his age and experience sort of sabotages Obama's whole push for, you know, change. I'm bringing change to Washington, D.C. Biden is a Washington, D.C. insider. He's been a senator since he was 29 years old. He's very much part of the whole federal process right now, and his age and experience really kind of make that whole push for change seem ridiculous. if you look at his foreign policy experience, too, Biden, as the foreign policy expert, voted for war in Iraq, you know, when it was obvious that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, when here on this show we were talking about how the push for war is ridiculous and the Democrats need to stand up and vote no. Biden lined up and voted yes. So much for his foreign policy expertise, quote unquote. And I think the fact that Biden was Obama's choice is clearly a sign that Obama isn't going to rock the boat. So change is just another slogan for him. It's not a reality. In fact, he's really on with the Democrats' platform, which is compromise till it kills you. Essentially, that's sort of the Biden philosophy. It's also going to be Obama's philosophy, I think, as well. Now, if we look at the Republican pick for VP, Sarah Palin, you know, the media has just been lining up. They love her. She's young and she's female. She has a family. You know, she's also a working woman. She appeals to social conservatives because, you know, she's anti-abortion and she has 5 kids. And she's a lifetime member of the NRA, and she's against gay marriage, et cetera, et cetera. She also ran for governor on an ethics platform in a state that's been suffering a lot of ethics scandals right now, particularly when it comes to kickbacks from the oil industry. Both Don Young and Ted Stevens, their 2 senators, have been implicated and in ethics violations related to oil industry companies. And Palin has an anti-oil reputation for having pushed oil companies in the state of Alaska to pony up more money in taxes, which has kind of beefed up the Alaskan state treasury and hasn't won her any friends in the oil industry. But if we look at what the media is not talking about, when they talk about Palin, she's too young to be on the national stage. She's had absolutely no national experience. In fact, I was reading in the newspaper this morning that her first trip abroad, she had to get a passport last year to take her very first trip abroad to Kuwait and Germany to visit troops in the field. That was the first time she'd ever been out of the United States. That disqualifies her right there. But when you look at it, she's had almost no experience in politics. She was the mayor of a tiny, tiny town in Alaska. She's been governor for about 1 year and 8 months. She's got all of these, really, even though she's a woman and she's hoping to pick up votes from Hillary Clinton supporters, she's got all the things that really disqualify her to be a leader of women or a spokesperson for women. She's strongly anti-abortion. She is, in fact, not pro-family when you look at her choice to have a child, have a fifth child, in an era when having 5 children might be considered, I think, this is my opinion, I think should be considered an environmental crime, particularly in this country where having 1 baby uses the resources of perhaps more than a full family in the rest of the world. Having 5 children, I think, is an environmental crime. But then when you choose to have your 5th child when you're 41 years old and you don't take into effect that that child could have a disability and, in fact, does turn out to have a disability and you decide anyway to go ahead with the pregnancy, I think that's questioning her, not her ethics per se, but questioning her ability to make responsible decisions, you know? I mean, I wouldn't want a person like that to be vice president of the United States. The fact that she appeals to social conservatives doesn't mean that she's right in the mainstream of the Republican Party. It means she's an extremist. In addition, she's a hypocrite because she says she's against gay marriage, and yet she says, I have gay friends, and she has done some actions as a governor. She's taken some actions as a governor that has advanced gay rights in the state, particularly benefits for gay state employees. So, in fact, she says one thing and does another, or at the very least, she feels she can pick and choose when it comes to gay rights. And I suppose you would consider that a luxury for a heterosexual person. But, you know, it really, to me, it questions her commitment to her own stated opinions and her own stated morals. In addition, she is under an ethics cloud. Even though she's been running as sort of pro-ethics and you know, I'm going to clean up state government, et cetera, she's under an ethics cloud. Her own Republican-controlled legislature has started an investigation of her because she fired the leading public safety official in her state for suspected charges for not firing her sister's ex-husband because they went through a messy divorce. Her sister's ex-husband is a policeman. So she clearly, it looks as if there's the appearance anyway that she tried to have her sister's ex-husband fired from his job. And her own Republican-controlled legislature thinks there's something behind that, and they've started an investigation of her. In addition, they say that, Palin has tried to clean up Alaskan politics, and she came into office taking swings at Don Young and Ted Stevens, the two senators from Alaska. She's made nice to Ted Stevens in the last few months, and she's actually been seen at a lot of fundraisers with him. She's been helping him in his primary campaign. She actually helped him win his primary and to raise funds. So, in fact, while she may have the initial appearance of being ethical, she's actually, you know, making nice with guys like Ted Stevens, who it looks as if he's guilty of taking money from oil companies. So, you know, she's willing to bend her ethics when it suits her. So I think the media needs to ask some harder questions about Palin. I think on top of this, the most important thing that disqualifies Palin for the job is the fact that as the governor of Alaska, she earned a reputation in the 1 year and 8 months that she was that she's been in office. She has earned a reputation for firing people who don't agree with her, instead of trying to bring them over to her side. Now, who does that sound like? To me, that sounds like Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. And the very last thing we need is a female version of Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld as the vice president of this country.
All right. Moving on, sticking with National just briefly, it looks like mad cows can breathe a sigh of relief this week.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The Bush administration has won a federal appeals court ruling against a small Kansas meat packer that wanted to test every single cow that comes in the door for mad cow disease. The Bush administration took the side of large meatpacking companies by saying, well, no, you can't test every cow that comes in the door, because then that means every other meatpacker will have to do the same. Otherwise, they'll look like they're slackers. And the Bush administration says, of course, that the low level of testing that's going on now, the FDA requires meatpackers to test 1% of the cows that come in the door. The Bush administration says that low level of testing reflects the rareness of the disease. That's the reasoning of a 5-year-old child. I mean, that logic simply doesn't play. That logic simply doesn't make sense. Just because a disease is rare doesn't mean you test less for it. It just means that the number of animals you test, a very small number of them will have it. It doesn't mean that you test less for it. In fact, testing less for it only means that you have a greater chance of an infected animal slipping through. So clearly somebody in the federal appeals court needs to go back to school and take a logic class. But I think really, in fact, this is a response to the big money in the meatpacking industry that's against testing for mad cow disease.
All right, and finally, international and the U.S. air war in Afghanistan.
Yeah, in the war in Afghanistan, we've been hearing, you know, that the Taliban are making inroads, but it really hasn't been quite as apparent, I think, until this week, when the largest number of civilians killed in any single incident happened last Friday. not this past Friday, but the Friday before, in the western part of the country, in the province of Herat, which has formerly been quiet. I mean, right after, in 2001, right after the Taliban were driven from power, the southern and southeastern parts of the country were considered hotbeds of Taliban activity and of Al-Qaeda activity, and the western part of the country was not considered a problem. Well, clearly now western Afghanistan is also involved, which leads us to ask the question of, okay, is the whole country under the control of the Taliban? Is the whole country, you know, at risk right now? And I think the answer to that question is yes. It's not just one third of the country. It's not just half the country. It's everywhere in Afghanistan outside the capital city. And in fact, we know that there are suicide bombings going on in the capital city. So even that's a problem. So Afghanistan is in flames again. And the 90 plus civilians that were killed last week were killed by U.S. aerial bombardment. The U.S. denies that. They say that only 5 civilians were killed. But the government of Afghanistan sent a crew out to investigate. The U.N. has sent investigators out. They both agree that it was 90-plus civilians, that it was U.S. aerial bombing that was at fault, that, in fact, this time it wasn't a wedding that was bombed. It was a funeral, and that the bulk of the dead were children, more than 50%. And the Afghan government has responded by saying, look, we're sick of this thing where the U.S. is doing its own raids, NATO is doing their own raids, there's no communication, nobody knows what's going on, you're bombing large groups of people indiscriminately. We want to do what's going on in Iraq, which is renegotiate the terms under which U.S. and NATO troops are here. We want a status of forces agreement. So we'll see how far the Afghan government gets with that. But clearly, Afghanistan is in flames and is becoming a major problem for the Bush administration.
Yeah, I know. Speaking with Dar Jamail previously about the surge in Iraq, that the success of the lower body count for U.S. People serving there, that's mainly attributable to the ratcheting up of the air war.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah, the ratcheting up of the air war.
And so that seems to be the military solution to when, you know, the numbers are too high in the media here in the U.S.
When U.S. deaths, U.S.
Exactly.
soldiers' deaths are
right.
too high,
Thank
then
you.
We ratchet up the air war because it removes our guys from the ground, puts them up in the air where they can drop munitions and not be fired at, or if they're fired at, the bullets don't reach them because they're too high up. Unfortunately, when you're, you know, 3,000 feet up in the air, it's awfully hard to see whether you're bombing Taliban militants or whether you're bombing people at a funeral. And in this case, that's what happened.
All right. Talking with Maria Tomchik with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
You can find Eat the State in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, places around town where you find free periodicals and other things like that. And you can find us online at www.eatthestate.org.